Amen. I wonder if you remember the great supermarket revolution in Australia, into a context of a duopoly that dominated the Australian landscape for decades, came a new competitor, Aldi. And to Aldi's credit, they didn't just come in and try to do what their competitors were doing. They had a point of difference. They made you return your trolley so you could get your $2 back. They made you pack your own bag to save money, apparently. And they gave you the chance to enter the magical world that is the middle aisle, where along with your regular groceries, you can buy a drum kit or ski gear or power tools, just what you were always looking for. But hidden in the marketing strategy of Aldi was the fact that they eliminated choice. Whatever product you needed, there was only really one on the shelf to choose. They had done research that suggested people are more likely to buy a product if they weren't given a choice. Their research suggested that people become frustrated when we have to make a choice and we are less likely to buy. But if there's only one type of corn chip, one type of honey, one type of pasta, then you eliminate all the other options. You don't have to sit there and look at the shelf and figure out which one is best. You don't have to do mental maths to figure out which one is cheaper or think about the ethics of where and how it was made. You just grab it because it's the only one on the shelf. Genius from Aldi, really. But it does highlight the fact that we find decisions harder to make the more options that we have. And when it comes to big decisions, we've never had more voices, more options confusing us. And I'm not just talking about what we purchase at the shops. I'm talking about life decisions, big decisions, decisions with great consequence, decisions about what we believe. We stress over these decisions because we're bombarded with so many options that we can't think clearly through all the noise. And this morning, as we come to the passage that we've just had read to us, we need to understand that the whole nation of Israel was right in the middle of making a huge decision. And as we examine this particular encounter, we're going to see that the decision is about what people believe about their God. And it's a decision that we all must make. We all have to decide what we're going to believe about God because it dramatically impacts the way we live our lives. So this morning, we're going to unpack two things that we must acknowledge when it comes to this decision. Two things that impact how we should think when we make this decision about God. The first verse of chapter 11 is a brief statement about the death of Samuel. And for those of us who've been following along in the series, we might find this weird that this man who had given so much to the nation, this man whom the whole book of the Bible is named after, would only get this one verse to summarize his death. That we're told that all Israel mourned his death. And not just because he had been a great leader, a great prophet, a priest, and a judge, but because of what was left in his wake. Those of us who've been following along in the series know that Samuel had anointed Saul to be the first king of Israel. But Saul had abandoned God, and the nation had suffered under his insecure and impulsive leadership. So Samuel had anointed David to succeed him. So for the last 10 chapters of this book, the nation has been living through a movement, a downward movement of King Saul as he has spiraled further and further away from God, and an upward movement, the rise of the waiting King David. And they've been living through the feud between these two men as David was forced into exile and Saul was pursuing him unto death. And this is the big decision the nation needed to make about their God. Would they side with Saul and go against everything that God was revealing to them? Or would they listen to God and join with David, God's anointed king? Well, over the last few weeks, a growing group of people had begun to see the truth that David was God's anointed and nothing could stop him fulfilling his kingly destiny. Samuel knew it, and he had anointed David, protected David. Saul's daughter and David's first wife, Michal, knew it, and she had protected David. Saul's son and David's closest friend, Jonathan, knew it, and he gave up his claim to be king in order to protect David. The priests at the tabernacle knew it, and they supported him. And last week we saw that even Saul himself knew it. In his moments of clarity, when he was not consumed with evil intent, Saul knew that David would be a far more godly king than he could ever be. And yet, Saul still clung to the notion that David was his enemy, an enemy he must defeat, an enemy he must kill. And there were plenty of people who were on his side. He had an army of loyal soldiers at his disposal. A couple of weeks ago, we met Doeg the Edomite, who was prepared to slaughter an entire town of priests in pursuit of David on behalf of Saul. So this is where we find the nation of Israel, stuck in this wrestle between Saul and David. And the hearts of the people were beginning to choose sides. Some, out of the fear of the king's wrath, were staying loyal to Saul. But others, out of their deep faith in God, were seeing the truth that David was the anointed one, the one to follow. And this division in the nation also expressed itself through division in households, division between husband and wife. In this chapter, we meet Nabal and his wife Abigail. Listen to what the text tells us as it introduces us to them. Verses 2 and 3. And there was a man in Maon whose business was in Carmel. The man was very rich. He had 3,000 sheep and 1,000 goats. He was shearing sheep in Carmel. Now the name of the man was Nabal, and the name of his wife Abigail. The woman was discerning and beautiful, but the man was harsh and badly behaved. He was a Calebite. There are a few things we need to pick up on here. Firstly, Nabal had his business at Carmel. If you remember back to chapter 15, King Saul, in a series of events that led to him being rejected as God's king, set up for himself an image of himself at Carmel. You know the kind of thing that insecure dictators do? Put up a statue of themselves so that people will know that he is in charge. This is what Saul did at Carmel. And it tells us that Carmel is a bit of a stronghold for Saul, an area where he enjoyed support from the people. If they were plotting which electorate voted for which politician, this one would come up in Saul's colour. They are all supporting Saul. Secondly, we note that Nabal is very rich. He has 3,000 sheep and 1,000 goats. And that might not seem too big to us compared to the kind of huge cattle properties we know in today's society. But this is in a time before mass farming, where the vast majority of people were in some form of agricultural business. And having a flock this large was reserved only for the super wealthy, which means he has a lot to lose if there might be change in the nation. If he supports Saul, it might continue to be good for him. If he supports David, things might change. He might lose some of his business, some of his wealth. Thirdly, we're told that Nabal is harsh and badly behaved. Nabal means fool in Hebrew. And so in many ways, we should not be surprised that his reputation matches his name. But it does perhaps help us understand how he established himself as a wealthy man. It's likely he has dealt harshly with others in business and been less generous towards those in need. And finally, we're told that he is married to a woman named Abigail, who is discerning and beautiful. We might ask, why do the harsh guys always end up with the beautiful girls? Seems to be what's happened here. Abigail means her father's joy. And so again, we should not be surprised that her reputation matches her name. In this context, discerning probably refers to a practical wisdom that flows from her faith in God. She can look at the big picture, see what God is doing, and make wise and good decisions as a result. Well, into this situation, this marriage, steps David and his band of followers. Still on the run from Saul, David comes upon Nabal's shepherds out in the wilderness, and from what we can deduce, acts to form protection for them. Later in the chapter, Nabal's shepherds recount that David and his men were very good to us, and we suffered no harm, and we did not miss anything when we were in their fields. As long as we went with them, they were a wall to us both by night and day, all the while we were with them keeping the sheep. Out in the wilderness, shepherds of large flocks would be targets for thieves. If a guy has 3,000 sheep, he's not going to miss one if a thief runs up and steals one from the outside of a flock. It would be a pretty easy target. But it seems that David and his men out in the wilderness saw Nabal's shepherds and decided to protect them and their flocks. When David hears that Nabal is going to be shearing his sheep at Carmel, presumably because that's where the shepherds were herding the sheep, he senses an opportunity to perhaps gain some support from a rich landowner. He had offered Nabal genuine service by caring for his servants and for his sheep and his goats, an act he would hope would be repaid with hospitality. So he sends 10 of his young men with the shepherds to greet Nabal and ask him if he might spare David and his men some food on the day of a religious feast. This might seem a bit weird to us, David working for Nabal before entering into any formal contract with him and still expecting to behave. Kind of like a neighborhood kid turning up at your house while you're at work, mowing your lawn, and then sitting on your driveway waiting for you to get home and say, "I mowed your lawn, can you give me some money?" Or those guys at the traffic lights that wash your windscreen and then expect you to throw them a few dollars. But hospitality was a huge part of Jewish society. In this culture, it was a far more expected practice where you couldn't just give Nabal a call on a mobile phone and ask him if he needed some help protecting his sheep. David offered the service and would have expected some form of hospitality in return. It's a normal and natural part of life in this world. So David's men arrive at Carmel with the shepherds of Nabal, and they pass on David's request, a request that is dripping with generosity and respect. From verses 6 to 8, we see the way that David appeals to Nabal. Verse 6, "Peace be to you, and peace to your house, and peace be to all that you have." Verse 7, "Now your shepherds have been with us, and we did them no harm, and they missed nothing all the time they were in Carmel." Verse 8, "Therefore let my young men find favour in your eyes, for we come on a feast day. Please give whatever you have at hand to your servants and to your son David." David blesses Nabal and his household, honours Nabal as he would his own father. "I'm your son," offers up the generous service that he has performed as a gift, and humbly asks for favour. Nabal has unknowingly benefited from David's service, and now he is enjoying the benefits of that service. He has lost no sheep, so he has plenty to spare. But when he hears David's request and discovers the service that he has benefited from, Nabal responds in the harsh and foolish manner that his name suggests. This is what he says in verse 10. "Who's David? Who is the son of Jesse? There are many servants these days who are breaking away from their masters. Shall I take my bread and water and my meat that I have killed for my shearers and give it to men who come from I do not know where?" There's so much that we can learn from his response. He asks, "Who is David?" And we would say, "What rock have you been living under? The whole nation knows about Saul and David." But he follows that with, "Who is the son of Jesse?" Now, David has not mentioned the fact that he is the son of Jesse. So this tells us that Nabal knows very well who David was. His question, therefore, is not one of genuine inquiry. "I don't know who David is." But it's a question of disdain. It's like he's saying, "Who does this David think he is? Or is who's David that I should care one iota about him?" And the title "son of Jesse" is also interesting here. It reminds us of the way that King Saul has distanced himself from David, who is technically his son-in-law. effectively disowning him. Back in chapters 20 and 22, six times Saul refers to David in anger, and on each of those occasions he calls him the son of Jesse. Nabal shows that he's very aware of the way that Saul has begun to refer to David, and that he has chosen to refer to David in the same way. He is choosing Saul's side. Finally, he brands David a disobedient and rebellious servant, inferring that he will not help one who has betrayed his master. Clearly, Nabal believes that David is in the wrong, has rebelled against Saul, when we know it's the other way around. Saul has tried to kill David numerous times for no reason other than his insecure jealousy. But again in chapter 22, we saw that in his blind rage, Saul believes that David is a rebellious servant who is intent on harming him. Nabal is once again trotting out the Saul party line. So Nabal sends David's servants away empty-handed, having insulted David and made his position abundantly clear. He is on Saul's side and will have nothing to do with David. Later, David would write Psalm 14, a song that begins with the words, "The fool," or in Hebrew, the Nabal says in his heart, "There is no God." And we have to wonder whether his encounter with Nabal here helped inspire that line. Because while we might be forgiven for thinking that Nabal is simply choosing a side here, and we should not be surprised that a friend of Saul would turn down David, we need to look more broadly than just the dispute between David and Saul. We have to look at what God was doing. Saul had been rejected by God in such a way that the whole nation knew he had been rejected by God. Saul had acted in ways that showed he had lost connection with God. Saul had committed atrocities that were a blight on the nation and nothing like God. But David had been anointed by God to be king, a king after his own heart. David had demonstrated courageous faith and brought honor to the nation. David had even repaid all of Saul's enmity with honor and grace, as we saw last week, when he had a chance to take Saul's life, but he respected the fact that he was the anointed king. Nabal's choice of Saul over David was more than a statement of politics. It was a statement of his theology. Nabal was ignoring everything that God had been doing to vindicate David as his anointed one, and believing everything that Saul had been saying to discredit David. His verbal abuse and rejection of David, God's anointed, was actually a rebellion against the God who had anointed David. And this is what the Bible defines as foolish. The foolish one, Nabal, the fool, says in his heart, "There is no God." Nabal is looking at everything God is saying, that God is doing in the nation, and he says, "Nah, not going to believe it. I'm going to believe what Saul is saying." Saul, the one who has set himself up opposed to the will of God. This is the definition of a fool in the Bible, and Nabal lives up to his names. But we have to confess, there are times when Nabal's foolish ways aren't that far from our own thinking. We easily believe voices other than Jesus, the true anointed one. We allow these voices to colour our perception of God. We let the broken state of this world convince us that God doesn't care. We let the desires of this world convince us that God is restricting our joy. We let our own sense of justice convince us that God is a tyrant. And we let the scores of celebrities and famous people out there who rubbish God convince us that history is moving in a different direction, that God is something of the past and we need to get with the program. Nabal's foolishness was a product of listening to Saul's ideas about David, but also because he completely ignored the gracious and generous way that David had treated him. David's service had benefited him greatly, but Nabal takes it for granted and shuns the one who had contributed to his wealth. And likewise, we can easily overlook the good that God has given us, the gracious way he has provided for us, the beauty of this world, because our perception of him has been tainted by other voices. The first thing that we must acknowledge when we are making a decision about God is that we have a propensity to give too much credibility to voices that rubbish God and ignore the grace that he has generously given us. We are a people who so easily get confused by all those other voices out there in the world. And we need to hear a strong and sure message from God. We need to see the good and the gracious way he has acted towards us. We need to see his truth and let that shine through all the fog and the confusion. The first thing we must acknowledge when we're making a decision about God is that we have a propensity to listen to voices that rubbish God and to ignore the grace that he has generously given us. Fortunately, there's a character in this story who shows us a better way. But it's not who we might think. It's not David. In verses 12 to 13, David's men return to and relay Nabal's reply. And David's immediate response is rage. Every man strap on a sword. He doesn't stop to think. He doesn't stop to seek God. He doesn't even consider showing restraint like he did in the cave last week. David simply calls his men to arms and takes 400 of them with him on an all-out assault against Nabal. Verses 21 and 22 reveal the motivations of his heart. "Surely in vain I have guarded all this fellow has in the wilderness, so that nothing was missed of all that belonged to him. And he has returned me evil for good. God do so to the enemies of David, and more also if by morning I leave so much as one male of all who belong to him." David rages. This goes to show that despite being the hero of so many of the encounters that we've seen in the last 10 chapters of this book, not everything that David does is perfect. Here, we almost see a bit of Saul in David. He's impulsive. He's insecure, too proud to suffer offense. He even makes a Saul-like oath to defend his own honor. It is true that Nabal had acted foolishly and rejected both David and the God who had anointed him, but David's actions here look to cross a line. So this week it will not be David who shows us a better way. It will be the unlikely hero, the discerning and beautiful Abigail. In verses 14 to 17, one of Nabal's shepherds doesn't like the way his master responded to David. And so he seeks out Abigail in the hopes of a different result. He informs her about David's generous and kind treatment of them in the wilderness, his request for supplies for the feast, and how Nabal had railed against David, and the likelihood of retribution falling on the household. The need for someone to do something because Nabal was such a worthless man that no one can speak to him. In verses 18 to 20, Abigail doesn't hesitate. She arranges everything that is needed for a generous feast and more. She loads it onto donkeys, sends it ahead of her towards David, then she gets on a donkey herself and follows behind. When she comes to David, she falls down on the ground at his feet and makes her appeal. Listen to what she says between verses 24 and 31. Verse 24, "On me alone, my Lord, be the guilt." She is prepared to stand in the place of her guilty husband if it means that her household will be spared. She is innocent, but she accepts the guilt and wants to spare her household wrath. Verse 25, "Let not my Lord regard this worthless fellow Nabal, for as his name is, so is he. Nabal is his name and folly is with him." She pleads with David to understand that her husband lives up to his name. He is a fool and it would be unwise of him to overreact to the babblings of a fool. Don't be fooled by the fool, is what she's saying. Verse 27 and 28. And now let this present that your servant has brought to my Lord be given to the young men who follow my Lord. Please forgive the trespass of your servant. She gives David everything he asked for, asked her husband for and more, in the hopes that it will appease him and purchase forgiveness. Verse 28, for the Lord will certainly make my Lord a sure house, because my Lord is fighting the battles of the Lord, and evil shall not be found in you as long as you live. She confesses her faith in God and her belief that David is God's anointed. This means she seeks not just to spare her own household, but to also save David from acting rashly, from having the blood of her household on his hands and disqualifying himself from his kingly calling. If David had gone ahead with his vengeful wiping out of this household, he would be no better than Saul, who wiped out a whole village because he didn't get his way. He would be no different, and no one would follow him. God would abandon him. And so Abigail says, don't let the blood guilt be on your head, David. Verse 29 and 31. This is fleshed out even more as Abigail outlines her understanding of David's high and holy calling, her trust that God would vindicate David in the eyes of the nation, and the need for him to trust God to work this salvation on his behalf rather than forcing it himself. The more I read of this passage, the more I marveled at the faithfulness of Abigail. She sacrificially puts herself between her foolish and harsh husband and the impulsive wrath of the man he offended. She could have easily suffered at David's hand because she was connected to Nabal's household. But she could have equally suffered at her husband's hand because she was going against his will. She cares deeply about all the innocent people in her household and longs to see their lives spared. But she cares equally for the Lord's anointed, seeking to save him from disqualifying himself from being king. Abigail is the perfect model of a courageous woman of faith. She speaks respectfully, truthfully, and from a motive of love. She acts sacrificially for the good of those around her. She acts faithfully, longing to see God's plan worked out for his glory. And because she is a woman of faith, and she appealed to David on the basis of her faith, her message and display of faith break through and soften the heart of a vengeful David. Verses 32 and 33. And David said to Abigail, blessed be the Lord, the God of Israel, who sent you this day to meet me. Blessed be your discretion. Blessed be you who have kept me this day from blood guilt and from working salvation with my own hand. Notice how David praises God on account of Abigail. He recognizes that her impressive, courageous faith was a gift to him from God. He knows that he would have corrupted himself, covered himself in blood guilt, and put himself above God if he had not, if it had not been for her intervention. So in verse 35, he accepts her gift and assures her that he will honor her request and that her household will not suffer. And here is the second thing we must acknowledge when we're making a decision about God. All of us need people of faith in our lives to intervene in our lives and save us from making foolish decisions about God. We all need people of faith. David has been the most faithful person in the nation to this point. David has been the hero of so many stories, and yet he still needs a person of faith to come and intervene for him. I'm not sure where you're at with God this morning, but the fact that you're here means that you have at least one person of faith in your life. Perhaps it's a parent, a sibling, a friend, a workmate, maybe even the person who invited you here today. You cannot underestimate the fact that God has put them in your life to help you make the right decisions about him. So taken with Abigail's faith was David that when her husband eventually meets the judgment of God and dies, David longs to make her his wife. Now, we can lament about the fact that David goes against God's plan by taking what would be his third wife, but we can understand that David longs to have a woman of faith like Abigail by his side. He recognizes his need for this woman of faith. And in the same way, we need people of faith in our lives to help us see the truth. I remember as a 16-year-old who knew nothing of God, I was simply living my life for myself with little regard for whoever I hurt, whoever I left in my wake. I was mean and I was selfish. I said and did things I was ashamed of, but I laughed it off or drowned it in alcohol to ease my conscience. I was on a fast track to a horrible life, a life absent from God. But God sent people of faith, people who courageously went out of their way to confront me with the truth, to share the grace of God with me, to plead with me to not keep racing towards destruction. I remember about a month after I finally came to faith in Jesus, a friend of mine at school said to me, "You didn't stand a chance. There's like 20 of us who've been praying for you for a year." People of faith who stepped into my life, sent by God to get me off that road to destruction and put me on a path towards salvation. We all need people of faith. Perhaps you have an Abigail in your life right now, a person of faith going out of their way, sacrificing for you, loving you, caring for you, and serving you in order to show you a better way, the way of God, in order to save you. Please consider this morning that God may have put this person in your life to point you to his truth. Maybe listen to what the person of faith has to say. Because this is the way of our God. Abigail stands in a long line of people of faith whom God has empowered to show us a better way, to save people, to save nations, and to even save us today from ourselves. Ultimately, Abigail points us to Jesus. Like Abigail, Jesus left his home at great personal cost, spoke the truth in love, sacrificially gave himself for the good of others, chose to bear the guilt of a sin that wasn't his, all so that the guilty party might be spared from destruction. Jesus is the ultimate man of faith who shows us the way to God. I don't know if you have an Abigail in your life right now. I don't know if you have a person of faith there, but we all have Jesus Christ, the ultimate man of faith who came to us from God as God to show us the truth of God, to save us from ourselves, to sacrificially stand in the place of our guilt and show us the way to salvation. My plea with you this morning would be to listen to this man of faith, to listen to the people of faith that God has put in your life, to listen to the people who, like Abigail, give of themselves to spare you from destruction. Listen to them, see the salvation of God, and reach out to him today. Let's pray together.